Good morning. Thanks for everybody for coming and braving it on a Monday morning. First off, I want to admit that it's been a long time since I've given a talk of this length. So I'm really worried about whether I'm grossly underestimating or grossly overestimating how much time I'm going to need. I have a couple of checkpoints, and I will definitely finish on time. If necessary, I'll skip some stuff. But my main concern is that if I'm worried, if I'm going to be able to, you know, finish, I go too fast in the beginning, so I'll try to slow myself down. Before I start, can I get a show of hands, the graduate students? Who are the graduate students in the audience? Oh, lots. Okay, so among the graduate students, who are people who sort of, you know, if given the choice, are you more sort of life science experimental person versus quantitative person? Who are the people who are coming down more on sort of experimental biological life science side? Okay, that's a fair number, all right. Okay, so I'll take that into account. I'm presenting a lot of work, which is done in collaboration with an experimental biology lab. And a lot of the quantitative analysis that I'm going to be talking about, I'll really try to sort of, you know, I'm not trying to talk down to the physicists and the audience, I know, right, you know how to do this. But for the biologists, I'll really try to, right, to sort of frame this in a sense of sort of why are we doing this and why do we think, you know, the analysis is going to give us, you know, what we think we need. All right, so I'm from the University of Denver. This is a picture of the University of Denver with the Rocky Mountains in the background. If you have never heard of the University of Denver, you don't need to feel guilty. I actually haven't heard of them either until I applied for a job there. So in NIH parlance, we are an undergraduate-focused institution. That means we're serving a lot of undergraduates. We're not an undergraduate-only institution, so we do have a graduate program. It's just very small, right? And so that means a lot of my work is done with graduate students from our small graduate program. Our entire department right now does not have a single postdoc, right? And there's a lot of people who are actually doing a fair amount of research with a lot of undergraduates. Some PIs actually specialize in having running labs with a lot of undergraduates. Okay? All right, so I actually want to do my acknowledgement slide first, so you know, in case I run out of time at the end. So this is my lab. This is a, you know, this picture is a little older. So the most of the work that I'm presenting today was done by graduate students Timothy Vanderleest and Taylor Furman, both of whom have now graduated, and then undergraduate Celia Smith, which is now in Princeton as a graduate student. And this was done in collaboration with the biological lab of Todd Blankenship, also at my institution in the Department of Biological Science. He's kind of like gesticulating like he's trying to hypnotize you, but this was a TED talk at DU. So this is also why there's, right, a percussion instrument in the background. So it's not because he's playing, right, the percussion. He was like, you know, in between, you know, different talks about, right, you know, music and some other things. But he gave a very nice TED talk a few years ago on germ band extension. And so in Todd's lab, the students who did the experimental work was, well, first of all, Celia, who worked in, for some time in my lab and did the experiments in Todd's lab, and Yi, who's not in the picture, Wei, right here, with Tim, and Kayla Jewett, who took the experimental data. Okay, so I want to, even though I will not presume to tell this audience about developmental biology, because I'm also relatively new to the field, I wanted to try and position the research that I'm presenting in the framework of a lot of Drosophila, right, development talks you've already heard, and I'm sure you're going to hear a few more next week or the week after, so maybe at the end of this meeting you'll all be sick of hearing about Drosophila. So we've already heard about sort of early stages of Drosophila embryo development, including syncytial divisions and cellularization, and then followed by formation of the ventral furrow. And germ band extension is at pretty much that stage after the furrow has formed, although I think that some of the germ band extension already takes place while the, you know, furrow formation is still in progress. So this is an example of a Drosophila embryo. This is the head side. This is going to be kind of like the tail side over here. So the furrow has already mostly formed or is forming right here at the bottom, where you don't actually see it because this is a side view. And this is the derm band, and the derm band is going to elongate, which is the, you could say, central step in the formation of the body axis, right? The elongation of the head-to-tail body axis, which all of you have, which flies have, which giraffes have, which other animals have. And so the derm band is this region over here. Obviously, this is false colored, so in an actual embryo, you couldn't tell by eye that this is the derm band and this is the amniocerosa, so you couldn't necessarily tell that by eye, but then this derm band is elongating, and because the entire embryo is in the egg sac, it can't really get longer, right, because the shape is predetermined through the egg sac. So as the derm band is getting longer, it kind of has to fold back on itself within the egg sac in order to achieve that elongation. And so seen from the side, right, so if you take a cross-section, you know, around this area over here, so you have the furrow, right, the mesoderm down here, and this side over here is the derm band, and you have the amniocerosa on top, and what we're interested in is the derm band over here, and I'll be talking about a lot of microscopy images, you know, where you're trying to press this area flat onto the glass in order to see how this portion elongates. Okay, so yeah, this is just another image from Jennifer Zahn's lab, right? So this is just a single fluorophore without the false color overlay. So you have the germ band down here, and at the end of germ band extension, you kind of see this entire tissue, right, sort of elongate and fold back on itself inside of the embryo, right? So this portion, right, sort of, you know, sort of flows over here to elongate the tissue. So this is a movie from Eric Wieschau's. The real time for this entire process is about 30 minutes, right? So you have the head over here, right? And you can see this flowing around, right? So you actually see a lot of flow and a lot of rotation in the image taken from the side, right? So there's anterior and posterior end over here. And at the end, a lot of these cells round up because of, you know, in part cell division, right? And so the stage where you start out with this fairly regular hexagonal overall tissue shape, right? And then you see this kind of flow around as the result of elongation. All right, and we know that in germ band extension, that extension of the tissue as a whole happens, we think, primarily through cell intercalation. And I think we've seen a couple of pieces of intercalation in different talks. Let me run this again. So I want to point out, maybe direct your attention to the red cells. Again, of course, these are false colored, but if you look at the red cells first, in the beginning, they're touching each other. And then over time, you can see that these interfaces, right, sort of you have elongation of new interfaces over here, right? The interfaces between red cells contract together into a higher order vertex, right? And then you have elongation of a new interface. So the interfaces that are touching in the beginning, right, these cells are now being separated by an interface. And so as a result, cells that were touching each other originally are now moving apart from each other. And cells that were not touching each other are coming closer together and forming a common interface. And so as a result, you have a row of cells, right? If you take this colored, right, false colored row of cells over here, right, these cells over the course of intercalation are losing their interfaces, right, and they're intercalating into the rows above and on top. And so as a result, this piece of tissue, which is sort of, you know, rectangular but a bit more square, right, if you look at the aspect ratio of this, you know, piece of tissue, actually elongates into this shape, right? And so if you can imagine, right, this takes place at the level of the entire tissue. So a lot of these vertical interfaces are contracting, right, sort of going into new interfaces. And so as a result, the tissue as a whole, right, converges in this direction and extends, hence convergent extension, converges and extends into that direction. And so at the level of individual cells, this intercalation is achieved just through a swapping of neighbors, right? So if you have these cells A and B over here, right, the interface between cells A and B, and these are neighbors into the anterior posterior direction, so we will call this an AP interface, right? So the interface between cells A and B contracts into this higher order, fourth order vertex, and then you have elongation of a new vertex, right? And so as a result, C and D come into contact with each other, and cells A and B, which were not in contact with each other, which were in contact with each other, are moving apart. However, unfortunately, there is a problem with the nomenclature Again, we've seen intercalation a few times over the course of the last 2 weeks. And this entire thing, right, if you look at, you know, theoretical physics or like physics of foams or biological tissues, this entire transition, right, with sort of contraction and elongation of new interface in foam physics, that entire transition is called a T1 transition. And in foam physics, and again, I've seen this in a talk last week, a T2 transition would be sort of a cell being squeezed out of the tissue, right, being removed entirely. Right? So unfortunately, within the field of developmental biology, there's a slightly different nomenclature, which doesn't help us at all. But this would be called a T1 state, right? So which is where you have the vertical interface. The T2 state would be the higher order vertex. And then the T3, right, shape or T3 state, this would be the elongation of the new interface. So I'll try not to mix it. I will actually try to stay with this nomenclature, just so you know, of course, in foam physics, this entire thing is called a T1. But right now, right, when I'm talking about a T1, that means I'm talking about this interface right here. T2 is where we have the higher order vertex. And then sort of stage 3 is just the elongation of the new T3 interface. Yeah, so that's unfortunate. I'm not sure, right, what the historical background is for sort of having T1, T2, T3 here, and that, you know, having a different meaning in theoretical physics. But yeah, it is what it is. Another interesting feature is rosettes. So, sorry, if I'm just going back here, you can see you have four cells participating, right? So you have this one interface contracting and elongation of a new interface. So you have two coming together and two being pushed out. There are also configurations where you sometimes have a number of linked interfaces contracting into a higher order vertex. So that higher order vertex, instead of having four cells appearing to be touching at the same time, you can have a configuration where you have five or six, or I think this is the highest that Todd ever found. I think this was 11, right? And so here you have the situation that you have these cells over here, and actually multiple of these interfaces here are contracting to the point where you have kind of have this flower-like, petal-like structure over here, and where you end up having a resolution, right, and elongation of a new interface between this white and sort of green marked cell over here, which were really far apart initially. I'm not going into much detail on rosettes, even though if there are people who are interested in rosettes here, right, you know, I'd be happy to chat with you, you know, more about that. I think these are interesting structures, but where you can imagine that in terms of topology, right, if you really think about the convergent extension gain, right, sort of you achieve more convergence here, right, because instead of just two cells on top of each other coming together, you have these cells, you know, which have a really large distance from each other coming together, and then these cells moving apart. So in terms of topology, these are interesting structures. Right, this is an image which kind of shows that sort of this is early in germ band extension, and right, you know, as time goes on, you actually start seeing more and more of these rosette-like features. So it's interesting to think about, right, are these in some way sort of, you could say, topologically or, you know, molecularly privileged structures or not, right? You know, do these arise from noise within the system? All right, so importantly for the T1 transitions, consisting of T1, T2, T3 states in this system, we know that there is a system of cellular planar cell polarity, PCP, that provides a basis for the symmetry breaking. You can imagine you're not going to get convergent extension if the interfaces that are contracting and the interfaces that are elongating are distributed randomly within the tissue, right? You get convergent extension if you have contraction of the vertical interfaces and then elongation of new horizontal interfaces. So what causes specifically and selectively vertical interfaces contract, right, and causes elongation of new horizontal interfaces? And there is a molecular basis for this. So it's been known, and you can see that by eye in microscopy images, that you have the system of preferential localization of myosin to these vertical interfaces. And in this case, we're always showing this as, right, the vertical ones being the ones that are going to be contracting. So we have myosin on the contracting interfaces, which seems like a logical fit. And we have a preferential localization of bazookas. It's just this bazooka, I'm not sure why. Of bazooka and PAR3, right, you know, which are, you know, stabilizing adherence junctions on the transverse interfaces. So these initially transverse interfaces, which are not yet the new interfaces that are forming, but the ones that are here initially. And so we know that this system of planar polarity provides the directional preference for intercalation, because if you take this away, right, then the sort of the systematic intercalation stops.
So may I ask, how complete is this segregation? Is it 80% of the myosin is on the vertical bonds, or 95%? Is this as stark as you're drawing here?
I do not know. I mean, the differences are significant. So in terms of sort of, you know, what amount of the myosin,
yeah.
I'm not sure whether, right, sort of the fluorescence intensity in itself really gives you like 100%. I would say the increase, right, into these interfaces is more than 50% in terms of the overall fluorescence intensity. And if you look at the specificity of that effect, we're seeing that the specificity of, right, you know, that sort of that ultimate contraction, right, is about, in controlled cells, I'm going to say sort of the sigma, right, sort of the noise, right, you know, within that specificity is 20%, 15 to 20%, right? So it's fairly specific in terms of the overall angle, both for intensity and the functionality. Given sort of the situation, that we know that we have preferential localization to the vertical interfaces or the transverse interfaces, one of the initial central hypotheses is that the myosin, of course, right, that seems like a very logical conclusion, that the myosin, which is preferentially localized at these vertical interfaces, creates additional tension, right? So it's localized to the contracting interfaces. There's more of it. You know, during the phase when they're supposed to contract, not before, right? Sort of, you know, in very early stages, you don't yet have that recruitment of myosin. The model for this is that the myosin at these interfaces increases their tension, right? And really line tension, if you think of these really like being springs, right? So they have increased line tension. And because they have increased line tension, they will start to contract. And some experiments done, I'm showing this example from Rodriguez Fernandez Gonzalez's lab, addressed this issue by actually doing laser ablation. I'll try to run this again, but you can see that this interface here was ablated by a laser. And of course, right, if you think of this like a spring, what happens is you ablate it and then sort of the other ends spring back. And so what that experiment does is ablate this and then measure the speed at which the opposite ends, right, of that ablated interface spring back, and look at the speed of that retraction. And so this is an example of a vertical interface being cut and then springing back at some specific speed. And then you can measure the speed at which they spring back. And then if you do the same thing for a transverse interface over here, right, so I'll run this again as well, but this is a transverse interface being cut over here. And then if you compare the speed, right, and then you find that these vertical interfaces, which are designed to ultimately contract at some later time point, are springing back faster, right? And the transverse interfaces, after they're being cut, are springing back more slowly, right? And so that idea is that the vertical interfaces have a higher tension, right? And so that higher tension, if you didn't cut them, would lead to them to contract. And the transverse interfaces are springing back more slowly, so they have lower tension, and so as a result, they're not designed to contract, right? So in the balance of these interfaces, that leads the vertical interfaces to contract.
Sorry, is there information in the angles of the tripartite joinings? They're right angles, you'd think that there would be more tension.
Yeah. So this specific study, right, you know, was not systematically corrected for the angle, right? And so that's something that also, right, which you can, let me go back to the beginning of that movie. I think it's easier to see, right? Over here, right? Where the angle of the, right, you know, adjoining interfaces is actually different than this one over here, right? And I agree that I think for some, right, sort of, you know, quantitative conclusions you would need, right, you know, to include the angle.
Also, the sum of the tension should be zero at every vertex.
Yeah.
So you can learn.
If you assume local quality. Equilibrium. Yeah. No, I completely agreed. Agreed.
You got me a second movie.
Yeah, second movie.
Yes,
yeah.
When you can you read?
Replay this? Yeah.
Dissection. It seems that more than having the recoil of the junction, you have an increase of area of the two cells, right?
That too, right? Yeah. And
is that expected to have just a full increase of the area of both cells?
I'm going to say that depends. So I don't think that you would necessarily need that, right? I think that would depend probably on the angles, right, you know, of the individual interfaces. But one issue was also between this study and the previous study, right, you know, that had looked at the ablation, was the size of the laser spot, right? So for these experiments, we're kind of pretending, right, that the laser spot is so small that it's sort of, you know, selectively cutting that interface, right? But, you know, it's not infinitely small, right? So, of course, that laser spot is actually, in reality, also cutting some of the, right, actomyosin structures inside of the cell. And in addition, you're doing this cut from, let me use a prop here, right? So this is your epithelial cell, right? Your epithelial cell is kind of like, you know, sausage sticking down. And right now we're looking at a cross-section of the apical end. So you're cutting an interface here at the apical end, but how far down does that cut actually go, right? I mean, the laser is going to cut a section over here, but that interface actually extends, you know, a good 30 microns all the way down, right? And so the other question is, if you're cutting it up here, it's not like you're instantaneously cutting, right, the interface, you know, through like a thickness of 30 microns. That's not happening, right? So I'm sure that in terms of, right, your mechanistic or not mechanistic, really mechanical interpretation of this, there are some open questions. I completely agree, yeah. And so one, you could say, sort of, you know, foundational model for this symmetry breaking is that we have myosin. Let me find my pointer, right? So we have myosin on the interfaces, right? And of course you have ecoturin, you have adhesions throughout, although you have more adhesions over here on the transverse interfaces. And then you have the cortical medial, right, and cortical actomyosin, and there's seems to be sort of a flow of actomyosin, you know, which you can see in fluorescence imaging towards the interfaces, and then these interfaces, it says here junction contraction, right, so you have these junctions contract really sort of through higher tension, and you have like this arrow going down and this arrow going up over here, so you can really think of this like a spring-like tension contracting. And then presumably, right, you have a deposition of myosin at the junction, right, and then you need to have a stabilization to prevent it from, you know, just being stretched back. But this basic model was really focused on, you could say, property, right, sort of tension properties of these interfaces individually. Okay, and so what we were trying to do, or what we started doing at about that time, was to try to integrate experimental data with some mechanistic modeling. So from the you know, just experimental side, this is an example, right, of an embryo, and I have the apical end at the top here. So right, we've had the discussion, right? So apical end always at the top. But so this is an example of a fly embryo pressed against the glass, right? So it's pressed against the glass up here. So we have a section of the embryo which is kind of fairly flat against the glass over here. And so we're really looking at this section over here, and then we're taking cross sections over here. This would be an apical cross section. You can take more basal cross section until you get signal extinction over here. This is an example of a, right, fairly apical cross section. And because we're constraining ourselves to this portion of the embryo where the cells are fairly at like right angle, right, with respect to the glass, at the sides, they kind of start sticking out as an angle, right? And so instead of getting a nice cross-section, you start getting these kind of angled cross-sections. So we typically constrain ourselves to looking at, right, sort of, you know, this patch here where the cells are angled fairly nicely. And then, of course, you can, right, you know, do a Z-stack and then do a reconstruction, right? So this is an example of a segmented Z-stack. And then you can get a segmentation, a 3D segmentation of the cells. I'm going to admit that this is like, right, sort of, you know, one of the best sort of 3D reconstructions that I'm showing you. I'm not showing you the really bad ones, obviously. But this is also one where, you know, we took care with the imaging to go really deep, right? And so this is a fairly realistic representation of the overall length of these cells. So all of these, right, so each one of these sausages is one epithelial cell. This is the apical end. This is the basal end. So they're actually really elongated. And in terms of actually really getting a signal, very often, right, even if we're taking Z-stacks, we can kind of like image maybe halfway down, right? So they, you know, they might be 30 microns long, right? And in most cases, you know, unless you get like, you know, sort of the perfect day where you have, right, you know, perfect imaging, everything comes out like, you know, just the way you want it. On like most realistic images, we might get, you know, so much signal extinction by 15 microns, right? You know, that, you know, further down, you don't really see very much. And of course, if you want to take really fast images, you would often, right, not take Z stacks at all, and you would just, you know, maybe stick to the apical end, right, and just take a time series at the apical end, in part because we think, right, you know, that these, you know, that the populations of myosin and actin, right, and all of the, you know, the relevant junctions that we have between epithelial cells are really localized to the apical end.
What is the marker for the segmentation?
So for that previous segmentation, this was this was spider Brazil. However, we have started doing a lot of gap 43, and so because of that, right? You know, the red fluorophore, the signal extinction is also getting a little bit better, right? But the early movies, earlier movies that I'm showing are typically going to be spider Brazil, right? And the later ones are going to be gap 43. Yeah. Did we have? Yeah. No. Or just somebody? Yeah.
What is the color coding?
Sorry?
What is the color coding?
The color coding, just to separate the cells, right? You know, so this is just numbered, right? The color coding just goes from cell number one to, you know, cell number whatever. So we wanted to have a little bit of shading to better, like, separate, visually separate the cells, right? It has no deeper meaning here. So that means also in the images that I'm showing, typically anterior-posterior axis will be left to right. So that's the head-to-tail direction. And in the images, up and down will correspond to the dorsal ventral axis, right? And of course, in addition, we have the apical basal axis, so I will try to specify in those cases where we have 3D information. And of course, based on the segmentation is all done with watershed transformation, right? So that's not rocket science. But so as a result, you can also extract more localized intensity data from this, right? So if this is, let's say, this is a vertex, right, with three interfaces coming out here, right, and then you do watershed segmentation, and with the watershed segmentation, you can produce, right, sort of a segmented area that corresponds to the interfaces over here. You can create an area that corresponds to the vertex, right, a little region of interest for the vertex itself, and you can define a local background, right, and so that means for each vertex, you can also read out intensity at the vertex, intensity at the interfaces right next to it, and then sort of, you know, you can subtract a local background where necessary just for some additional image analysis. Now, at the same time, in order to validate some of these, you know, experimental hypotheses, we wanted to have a toy model, right? So we build ourselves a toy model where we construct a lattice, which is supposed to represent the cross-section, say, at the apical end. And then you can, you know, take this cross-section, this tissue configuration, and involve it, right, in your computer over time. We would typically do that in a Monte Carlo simulation. So graduate students, especially the experimentalists, who's heard of a Monte Carlo simulation? Yeah, well, yeah. I was asking the graduate students here. Yeah, okay. Those of you who've heard of it, like you've read about it, could you explain it to a friend? So, okay. All right, so Monte Carlo simulation. In a Monte Carlo simulation, you take a starting point, right? So let's say this is our starting grid. I think this configuration was actually taken from like an experimentally measured grid, right? So we take this grid conformation here, the configuration where we have vertices and interfaces, you know, which is taken from an experiment. And then this tissue, this piece of tissue, is being assigned an energy, right? So we assign an energy to this configuration. This configurational input, this configurational energy really depends on the morphology, right? So that energy, it's right, you know, you have an equation which says energy is equal to, and then you have a bunch of terms that depend on the morphology, right? So things like cell size and cell shape, right, all go into this configurational energy. Then what we do is, okay, we have this energy, we have the grid, we have the energy, then we perturb randomly all of these vertices, so the positions of the vertices are going to be changed, right? You really just put like Gaussian noise on top of it, so you perturb the positions, right? So imagine you're taking this and kind of like shaking it a little bit, right? And so all the positions are perturbed. By perturbing the positions, obviously you're also changing the configurational energy, right? Because, you know, all the lengths and the, you know, area sizes of these cells go into the energy. So you're not changing the configurational energy. And then you're looking at all of these perturbations and you're saying, if your perturbation decreases the energy, right, that sort of, you know, that means you're going into an energetically more favorable state, then you're accepting that perturbation. However, if you're if you have a perturbation that increases your energy, that makes it a less favorable, right, configurational energy, then you're saying, okay, you're either rejecting it outright or you have a teeny tiny probability, right, of accepting this. And so, yeah?
How does the myosin distribution fit into this model?
The myosin, I will come to that, right, next slide. Yes, I will come to that next slide, absolutely, yeah. And so, you know, if you have a less favorable, right, you know, configuration, you're rejecting that change. And so that means over time, and then you repeat this, and again, and again, and again. So that means over a long list of, like, perturbation, you're slowly evolving into a state of lower energy, right? So you're accepting those perturbations that lower your energy. So over time, you're kind of like shaking. And so over time, you move into a configuration of, into a configurational, let's say, energy minimum, right? And so you keep on sort of decreasing your energy, and at some point, you've probably reached a minimum. So you do that over time.
How do you choose the parameter C?
Which parameter C?
The denominator of the
power. Oh, yeah, the probability. I think there is a little bit of hand-waving involved here, right? But what we try to do is actually relate this to experimental data, where we said, right, sort of, you know, what kind of movements do we have?
So it's not a temperature, which, as it would be in equilibrium.
It would be, yes, it would be, right? Yeah.
It would be, but it's not here.
Yeah.
So presumably it's related to the non-equilibrium dynamics somehow. How do you think of it in this context? I mean, it's a great way to find minima.
Yeah.
It's like simulated annealing or something, but I just wonder what this has meaning, a biological meaning, or is it just an artifice for finding a low energy state? And why should you go to a low energy state in a far from equilibrium biological system anyway?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question, but I think sort of the answer to that is that I think that, you know, a Monte Carlo simulation and sort of this procedure, you know, has been shown in many biological systems to be sort of an effective mimic, right, of non-equilibrium processes, right? So the important thing is that for the Monte Carlo simulation, right, sort of you shake, repeat, the individual iterations, right, sort of introducing noise and then accepting or rejecting those perturbations do not correspond to time. Right, and so it's not like you can say, you know, you do a plot where you look at your energy, right, over as a function of the number of iterations, right, and so the number of iterations are not a good substitute for time at all, right, and so sort of in an ideal world we would, you know, just want to put KBT in there, right, you know, and be done with it, but I think it also matters, right, how big you make the noise that you're inputting into the system. Right, and so, you know, we're putting noise into the system and we try to, you know, have sort of a reasonable, I think it's, in some ways it is an artifice of saying, okay, it gives us a step size that's appropriate to the type of process that we're trying to mimic.
Well, this procedure would go in the limit to equilibrium, to the Boltzmann distribution. But if you start with something that comes from a real image and that's not a sample of that distribution, then you'll have a transient approach to the mathematical equilibrium, which could could be a good dynamical model of observations if it fits.
Yeah. And I mean, there's obviously other ways to do that, right? You know, other people also have deterministic system where, you know, you're really taking your original configuration and you're saying you're trying to calculate forces which are trying to move these vertices, right? And so, you know, these are different approaches to getting the same thing, but to start with an original configuration and, like, evolve it in your computer over time, right?
So what is the origin of the name Monte Carlo? Is it because of
Monte Carlo?
Was
yeah.
Used,
The casino. Yes, casino. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Sometimes you win.
Yeah. Yeah. So because of the sort of probability aspect of it, right? So yeah. Okay, so one of sort of, you know, multiple ways to do this. And where different models are going to differ is in that original configurational energy, right? I mean, you know, you can take anything, including things that, right, you know, where, you know, you're not saying that this is right, you're not an equilibrium system, but you can put anything into the model. Whether it reflects the real system is a different question. But what sort of distinguishes one model from the other is that original equation where you define the configurational energy, right? Because the configurational energy is saying, okay, this is what actually matters to this particular system. And so the original models, right, you know, that were used to describe convergent extension, including, right, you know, one of your papers, had a model which is, you know, really inspired by topological transitions in foams, where you also obviously have these T1 transitions, right, you know, where this interface can contract into a higher order vertex, and then you have, right, elongation of a new interface, right? So very similar. And these models then have energy terms. And I will actually explain what these mean. Let's say this is your configurational energy, right? And it has a term that comes from the cell area. It has a term that comes from cell perimeter. And it has a term that comes from original interfaces. And you can do foams with these two original terms. And this is just some coefficient, right? You know, that goes to the front of this that tells you how much you're weighting, right? You know, the contribution of energy from the area and from the cell perimeter. And what this means, this is the area of a given cell. Here you're summing over, right, of all the cells that are participating in your tissue. And you're taking their actual area minus some target area. And so what this term does, it tries to conserve area. And since we're taking a cross-section, that means what we're trying to do is volume conservation, right? So that means the cell will resist being squeezed too small, right? So if the area gets too small, the cell will start pushing back, right? Also, if the area gets too large, the cell will also start pushing back, right? So that means the cell tries to actually come to an area, so the most favorable energy for the cell is an area which is close to that target area, which it's trying to conserve. Then we have a term for the perimeter. For the perimeter, you can also put in a target, right? A target perimeter. I've seen some papers that do that, which do actually write pi minus p naught and then square it. But it's functionally the same thing. So the cell also tries to preserve its perimeter. So it's going to resist, right, being blown up too large because that will increase the perimeter too much. And it might also, right, resist being, you know, pushed into, you know, too small perimeter. So these are really, you could say, right, you know, shape and, you know, area and perimeter conservation. So these are really elastic terms. And then for Drosophila germband extension, that there's this additional term, which is, right, so this is summing over the area of the cell, summing over, right, the perimeter of the cells. And this is different index, J instead of I. This term is not summing over all of the cells in the tissue. This term is summing over the interfaces in the tissue. And what you can do in this term, and I think that addresses your question, in this term, you can say, okay, now we're going to assign all the vertical interfaces one specific energy and all the transverse interfaces some other specific energy. So this term is where you can input planar polarity, where you can say, you know, all of the interfaces within a certain, you know, degree, you know, angle window, right, are assigned one specific energy, right, and sort of, you know, the others are assigned a different energy.
I can ask a question. So if both the first and the second terms tell you something about elasticity,
yeah,
why do you need both of them? Why not just have any term for area?
Because of shape restoration, right? So an area could be distributed any way, right? Sort of a round cell can have the same energy as a long and thin cell. However, you know, what we see in these original, if you look at one of the images of the, let me see if I can find this. Here, right? Originally, these cells are kind of roundish. I mean, obviously they're
very elongated cells.
Sorry?
Analyze is very
nice. Yes, exactly, right? So that combination of the area term and the perimeter term together tries to make cells round, right? And so that means it's going to resist not just, you know, area, absolute area changes, but it's also going to resist, you know, becoming too long and thin. So it's going to try to, you know, kind of maintain a roundish, overall roundish shape.
Right, lambda J is a time dependent.
Sorry, what is?
Lambda J?
Yes, you can make it.
It's related to Meissen concentration, which is presumably a time-dependent one. And if, but its dynamics is assumed to be much slower than the dynamics of the tissue, right?
Well, or let's put it this way. If you take, Durban extension, and you kind of like try to go like 10 minutes before, right, your actual intercalation starts. So in the beginning, you don't really have planar polarity. You don't have myosin yet. And then you have sort of, fairly on these timescales, fairly fast recruitment, where you actually see, I think, actin, right, planar polarity comes first. So you actually see actin planar polarity first, and then you see, myosin and bazooka par 3. That is relatively fast on these timescales, but I would make the point, and of course you're absolutely right, and I know that there's also some papers who are really trying to, model explicitly the temporal onset, right? I think some of Rodrigo Fernandez Gonzalez's papers did that, right? Where you have like a time dependence, but like I was saying, the Monte Carlo simulation doesn't really have proper time in there, right? It just has numbers of iteration. So what we try to do in the Monte Carlo simulation is really that we're taking, let's say, starting value, where we're saying, okay, we're now at a time where, we're basically pretending that zip, everything is now polarized, right? And starting from that polarized, right, state, if you just polarize it, where does it evolve, right? If you leave it alone, otherwise, you just polarize it, where is it going to go in overall shape polarization? So including the temporal dependence is really interesting. I think that's a really interesting problem. It's just hard to put it in properly into a Monte Carlo simulation. Yeah?
What is the significance of the third term being linear in the length of the edge interfaces? I mean, if I was considering these things to be like a kind of springs between each intercellular junction, right? You can imagine there's also some rest length that's set by density of myosin or something. Normally that would be like some quadratic term that didn't care about the...
Ah, okay, yeah. That is interesting. I think sort of that makes a quantitative difference, but maybe not a qualitative one. But there's one important point that you can also think of this term, and I think you will find this in some other papers. There's a very, very nice paper that was Reza Farhadifar from Frank Ulicher's lab, which had, sort of really going into the depths of all of these terms. You can think of this term as being, if you will, a generic interface tension. And so, of course, right, and in our current interpretation, this generic interface tension really means spring-like tension, right, because we have myosin and it contracts like a spring. However, in a physical sense, that generic interface tension could also be some tension related to adhesion, right? And then the physical interpretation is not that it really contracts like a spring, but then that tension could actually have a different sign, right? And it could actually mean that if these are longer, right, that's actually energistically more favorable. Because if you have on these interfaces, right, something that sticks together, right, then they like to be long, right? So instead of having, right, an energy that you try to minimize, they could also have, right, an energy which it tries to maximize, right, because they're sticking together and you have adhesion. So you could say this kind of comes from that idea of having this like very generalized interface tension, which can be, really mechanical spring-like tension, but could also be something else.
So this equation is for the cells, right? But if you wanted to write the equation for the foams, is there a term that you will add or remove from this equation?
So from what I understand, for the foams, you can just do these two.
So that would be sufficient to have T1 transitions. Mm-hmm. I mean, T1 to 2 to 3.
Yeah, in foams, right? Where you don't have like external forces or anything. So these would be sufficient for a foam. Right, in our system, this is where the planar polarity comes in. And there's also been discussions about, right, the fact that you're kind of like double counting perimeter here, right? You have perimeter in this term over here, right? But then you're summing over all of these interfaces. So you have perimeter once, and then the sum of the interfaces. So you kind of like have double perimeter, right? But this is functionally just very effective for actually introducing planar polarity into this.
So could you still have in cells passive intercalation, that means with just the first two?
Yes, you could, right? Provided that your noise is large enough, right? But sort of, if you have no planar polarity, right, and you just take this, system and add noise to it, then you can still have these passive random ones. However, obviously in that case, right, they could sometimes be in this direction, but they would also sometimes be in this direction or in this direction, right? Then you wouldn't have any directional preference in this.
So just a comment and a question.
Yeah.
In the middle term, as you said, you could have subtracted off a background perimeter.
Yeah.
And then I think the final term is just shifting that background perimeter, allowing it to be cell-specific. just changing.
I like that idea. Okay. I like that. Okay. Yeah.
But now, in that spirit, though, couldn't you have a different target area for each cell?
Yes, absolutely.
The initial thing. So the H0 could be different for every cell.
It could also be H0i, and we've actually done simulations where we're saying, okay, we have to allow this to be variable, right, between one cell and
just
another.
Just complete the square in the last two terms.
Cell-specific
target perimeter.
And I mean, and even if you do introduce a P0 in here, right, you know, it leads to an offset, but right, it doesn't change the differences here. But sort of one of the important points that I'm trying to make is that, you know, what kind of, you can write a model for anything, right, whether or not it represents a physical or biological reality is another question, but how different, you know, models differ from each other in these types of Monte Carlo models and in simulations is how you define your energy term. So what do you put into your energy term, right? Sort of, you know, how minimalistic are you, or what types of processes are you trying to explicitly put into your energy terms? And, you know, something that you put into your energy will be considered, right, for this morphological evolution. And so this is an example where we did just this, right? And we're not the first people, you know, to have done this by any means, but we wanted to try this in our toy model, right? And so we're putting in target areas and the interface and the perimeter, and we're allowing an initial sort of a plane of polarized distribution of these line tensions. And then, you know, you put that into your computer and you evolve it over time, and you can see that this entire tissue converges and extends, right? So you have actually very fast convergence in this direction, where these interfaces here get shorter, and then they start elongating in the other direction, and over time it kind of, right, expands in the other direction.
So in this case, is it like if you have dissected out the tissue from the embryo and you have put it on a petri dish?
Yeah.
And of course, there are tissue on the top and on the bottom.
Yeah.
They probably are not intercalating.
Mm-hmm.
So if you change the boundary condition, what would happen?
Yeah. Things would go, first of all, more slowly or, you know, more quickly, depending on the boundary conditions. However, I mean, we do know that I'm particularly concerned with boundary conditions here, right, and here, right, that allow it to converge. So we know that it does converge, right, you know, so, you know, it's not mechanistically prohibitive, but I think in terms of, you know, making this large enough, right, or putting in correct boundary conditions, right, that's not entirely trivial. But this, you could say that, or I would make the point, right, you know, that's imposing external boundary conditions, you know, both in terms of, right, you know, forces that prevent it from moving in direction or forces that promote it, right, you know, in terms of moving in specific directions. But the goal here was to, right, you know, put in a minimalistic model, just put in, right, sort of planar polarity and see what happens, and voila, right, you know, it convergently extends.
Are there a set of parameters you could put in that would give you rosettes in your model?
Oh, yes. Actually, you could. This is not shown really well here, but a prerequisite for a rosette is to have linked interfaces that are contracting. And if you start with a two perfect hexagonal lattice, right, then the vertical ones are contracting, but the transverse ones are not, you're never going to get rosette this way. And what you need to put in is a little bit of disorder, right, you know, which can come from the angular distribution, and that way you can actually get rosettes.
It looks here like the cells with four sides are becoming very small. Is that something that you see in experiments, and maybe something that you could tune your parameters to control?
Yeah, we actually don't see that a lot. So, right, I thought this was interesting because this is like a model for extrusion, and we weren't really interested in extrusion here at all, right? But in terms of the energy, at some point you could see that cell, right, kind of just gives up, or, right, you know, that the energy minimization of the rest of the lattice sort of overrules, right, you know, the interest of that individual cell to maintain its area.
So I was wondering, if you change the boundary condition and you put some external forces, could you think you could increase the passive intercalations?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I'm sure that if you impose external forces, I'm sure that that's what happens. And to some degree, you could even say, well, you know, you're putting in this, you know, hexagonal lattice, and you're putting in planar polarity, you know, which makes certain types of interfaces energetically less favorable and others more favorable. You know, it's almost trivial, right, that of course, right, the less favorable ones are contracting. And so if you impose external boundary conditions, there's no question that sort of appropriate external boundary conditions, right, sort of, you know, more force here, right, or less force in that direction, that would also, right, you know, impose planar polarized forces, and that would help with the extension. Absolutely. Yeah.
So where does the TO transition initiate in the tissues? Is it from basal side or apical side?
I will actually come to that in a couple of slides. I will address that specific point.
Is there a reason why the energy term is called Hamiltonian? Because usually Hamiltonian systems, they conserve energy, so they don't really move and go to a minimum unless you add some, you know, dissipative term. So in your previous slide, why the energy is called Hamiltonian, is this really an Hamiltonian system? Because if it is, then you don't go to minima. You just stay on the same energy. Maybe it's just a naming.
Maybe that's just a nomenclature. Okay, so but in the interest of time, let me move on. One important question here is, right, you know, you put in plane polarity, you see it convergently extend. This was a discussion we also had last week and the previous week a little bit, the question of whether these T1 transitions in the system, are they pushing or are they being pushed, right? So are these passive transitions that happen as a result of external forces, right? Or are these transitions themselves, right, an active process that generate force that pushes the tissue as a whole, right? So it's the tissue being squeezed, and as a result, you have these, you know, passive deformations, or are these deformations the force that, you know, causes the tissue to go out? And so, first of all, the tissue is planar polarized, right? If this was a passive process in response to external forces, why would you need the planar polarization, right? And as Frank Jülicher was saying last week, right, he also did this model where he showed that that, by definition, produces an active process. A second piece of evidence is that if you remove planar polarity, right, so for example in bazooka mutants, you inhibit convergent extension, right, so without the planar polarity in that system, you don't have convergent extension. And very, very importantly, in the presence of planar polarity, these T1 transitions happen even if the tissue extension is mechanically blocked. This is one of my favorite papers. The image quality, I couldn't get a high resolution, higher resolution image over here. And so this was an experiment done where, so this is the wild type over here. And this is taking an embryo where you cauterize, right? So you actually sort of burn, right, the embryo over here. And as a result, the extension of the tissue is inhibited. And this is a mutant where you have a blocking of the posterior midgut invagination, which is kind of like a pulling force over here. So these are two experimental interventions that actually mechanically block this tissue from undergoing convergent extension, right? So the tissue as a whole cannot extend because it's mechanically blocked. And so this is hard to see over here, but what I wanted to point out is, and this is one of my favorite figures from that entire paper, was that you see these neighboring cells, right? So you see a T1, T2, T3 transition over here. So this interface here contracts, gets shorter. Here, it's pretty short. And here, you've elongated a new T3 interface. So you see, even though mechanically this tissue is blocked from extending, these T1, T2, T3 transitions are still happening at the same time, even though you will notice that these cells right here are kind of being squished, right? You know, they start out being, you know, fairly rounded shapes. But over here, you do have that T3 extension. But these, you know, these cells end up, you know, being squished into kind of like weird shapes. Right? So this paper right here, right, present company, you know, can answer more questions about this, but where you can see that, you know, the T3 even happens, even though, right, the tissue as a whole is not elongating. So that would be strong evidence in favor of saying, well, it's that T1, T2, T3 transition which tries to push the tissue out. So, right, even in the absence of these external forces, you still have that transition happening right here. One important point here is that what happens, right, is actually not just T1 contraction into the higher order vertex, but also this T3 elongation. So that raises a question. In our previous energy term, where did the T3 elongation actually come from? In this term, we're making vertical interfaces, these T1s, energetically less favorable. As a result, they contract. It's like, you know, that's not surprising that that happens. But once we have these T2 higher order vertices, you know, this entire tissue could be stuck, right, in these kind of diamond-shaped T2 vertices, as you were seeing earlier in that simulation. So why doesn't it, like, cannot just stay in the T2? Why does it, right, extend into T3? And the reason is that as an interface contracts, it forms, right, goes from a hexagon to a pentagon. right? But as they contract the new interfaces, you have pentagons being restored to hexagons. In terms of the shape restoration, perimeter per area, hexagons are more favorable than pentagons. So it's really the shape restoration, right, going return to a round shape that actually produces the T3 extension in the system. But wait. These don't actually look particularly round, right? This is early, right, in germ-band extension. This is kind of mid. This is late. They look more disordered than they did here. They don't actually look like they're restoring a round shape. And they really don't. If you try to measure this quantitatively, right, you know, where you measure like a shape factor, some type of shape metric, you can see going from early germ-band extension to late germ-band extension, this entire tissue, right, shape factor goes up, and then pretty much stays up. And if you, instead of aligning this, right, you know, just over time, if you align this to the individual T1, T2, T3 transitions, right, you see shape factor goes up, right? This is the higher order vertex position, right? And then it goes into T3, you have elongation of the new T3, but it doesn't really do much to the shape factor. So in the model, right, you know, that we were running, it's the shape restoration that drives T3 elongation, but we don't actually see any shape restoration in the experiment.
How do you define the shape factor?
I'm going to say this is perimeter over square root of area, something like that. Yeah, so to make it dimensionally equal, we have to take like square one or like take the square root. So I think it's perimeter over square root of area. But so that shape factor goes up and kind of stays up, right? So we don't actually see a restoration of the round shape. And what we did for this particular system is that we took our Hamiltonian energy term, right? So energy, Hamiltonian energy, which is associated with a specific configuration and configurational energy, and we applied it to the experimental data. So we took experimental data, right, which we had segmented. So we have that configuration, and then we're just calculating the Hamiltonian energy for the experiments that we're seeing. So we kind of like reverse engineered it, right? So we're sort of, you know, putting that energy onto the experimental data. And we said that in the Monte Carlo simulation, you're always trying to minimize energy, right? But we find that sort of with without anisotropy, right? So if you don't put in planar polarization, the configurational energy just increases. It's supposed to decrease. If we put in planar polarity, it decreases up until, right, sort of the higher order vertex, and then it kind of like stays the same, right?
So I was wondering, I mean, this shape which is not restored, it seems that it's only for certain cells, like a salt and pepper effect. It's not an average effect.
Yeah.
So it's like, I mean, I'm sure you're measuring averages, but it seems some cells are completely restored. Maybe they're even a bit wider because other cells maintain their, but it's more like the variation.
Yeah, also the heterogeneity,
wide.
Right? Not just all of them, but the heterogeneity, right? That's a good point. Yeah, I don't think that I've looked at that, right, sort of in detail. Yeah, but that's a good point. And so we see that, right, sort of even if you put in this, you know, planar polarity, right, the energy goes down, right, and then it reaches higher order vertex, and then it kind of like hovers over here. So if you think of, right, sort of your cellular system as, you know, as it evolves minimizing an energy, it's not our energy, right? Whatever energy it's minimizing, it's not the term that we're putting in, right? So clearly, right, the term that we have, right, isn't working exactly in the way we need. And so that means we actually get this elongation, or we get this this energy difference, if we put in spatial anisotropy, not just for the contracting T1s, but also for T3s, right? So that we're saying for the T3, there also has to be some type of planar polarized effect that you need to input into your system.
So as I understand it, the second transition, you're not doing this rounding minimization, and I think you suggested that rounding minimization came out of those first two terms.
No, the rounding minimization is implicit in these two.
Exactly, those
yeah.
two terms.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So my question is, are those two terms necessary to do T1, T2, or can you get T1, T2 entirely out of that term, and the whole front end of your equation is not really what's going on?
So if you didn't have these terms at all, the cells could collapse,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, you know, to have them sort of remain at some, you know, target size and not go to, let's say, you know, obscenely weird shapes,
yeah.
you do need those two terms, right? But you can regulate the...
Some kind of bounding terms rather than actually dynamical terms that are contributing to the minimization in a fundamental.
Yeah, and you can see that these terms also have like some coefficient associated with it. So that's also like a scaling factor. So where you could say, how much do they contribute, right, you know, to that overall effect, right? And so you can imagine you can get that effect by kind of like scaling those down, where you're saying you're still penalizing if they get too small or too big, right? You know, but you want to have this, you know, term maybe like dominate over the other effects.
But have you tried getting the T1, T2 transitions with hardly any of those terms feeding in? And is it mostly coming out of that third term?
So the transition comes mostly out of this term, right? These terms are really for making the cells, that the cells don't collapse or go away, right? That they kind of stay the same size, but these terms by themselves would contribute absolutely nothing to the systematic transition, right? They just make make sure we have cells at the end of the simulation, that they don't go away, yeah.
Could I ask another just question? So also, what are the assumptions about the, like, along the length of the cells? Like, whether you have to have sort of symmetry? Like, does it actually all move in unison, or could you be getting, like, deformation, you know, really pyramidal kind of shapes?
Yeah,
or like
could.
How? Yeah, so.
Yeah. On average, we don't, but yeah. You could. It would be possible to happen, yeah. Okay, so you would need spatial anisotropy, right, in the T3 as well. And this was the original simulation, which only has, right, plane polarity for T1. And this is one that has plane polarity also for T3. And they both do the same thing, right? They convergently extend. But you can see that this one has morphologies that are actually more similar to what we see in real cells, right? And so the difference is that we've put in an active mechanism into the system over here.
So what does it mean in terms of your equations? So in the original formulation, you had, before the tissue was patterned, there was equal cost to interfaces, and then you made vertical interfaces more costly, and they want to go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so this additional anisotropy tells you that the horizontal interface is more favorable.
Yes, exactly.
Even more favorable.
Yeah, yeah. Right? So originally, we just had two levels. We had vertical and transverse, right? Sort of transverse have higher energy. T1 interfaces have highest energy, right, and transverse have lower energy, right, that made transverse more favorable. And now we're putting an even lower, like a third level, right, even lower, more favorable energy for these elongating, right, you know, transverse, these elongating T3 interfaces.
In terms of your model, it means that your capital lambdas depend on some angle with respect.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Angle only? Because you're saying elongating.
The new elongating ones, actually, it doesn't matter in which direction they're elongating. We're just saying, right, you know, if this is the new contact, right, between the cells that were not originally touching, we're giving that a different energy.
So that's an aging process. When you start a new interface, you assign it lower energy, and then gradually you bring that up to the big...
No, phase. Instantaneous. It's instantaneous.
No, but afterwards, once your new... interface has been formed.
Yeah.
You
mm-hmm.
keep this lower energy just because it has been
created. For this one, we kept it. Yeah.
So any edge that was created after the start of the simulation would have this lower energy.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then it's different than just having lambda as a function of some angle defined to the global coordinate system.
Yeah, so the original one depends on lambda, but for the ones that are newly formed, right, you know, they're actually formed regardless in which direction they're pointing. Okay, and so with that additional level of anisotropy, we actually get an energy that actually does decay, which is more realistic. Okay. Okay.
But you don't extend more.
Sorry?
You don't extend more.
Well, the question is extend more
globally
over what time? Again, right? You know, we don't really have time associated with these. So over a given number of iterations, they extend faster. Right? But again, sort of the number of iterations of the simulation don't really mean anything in time. And I'm thinking that, you know, in terms of biology, I'm sure that that sort of, you know, that plane of polarity does have time dependence, right? In the same way that the T1 has time dependence, I'm sure that the T3 also has time dependence.
So when does this simulation stop? Because after this kind of rearrangement, there are new vertical junctions.
Yeah, this the simulation just stops after the change in energy drops below a certain threshold, right? We're saying, okay, right, you know, this is not evolving very fast now, right? And so, right, we just stop.
So is this x-axis iteration number?
No, this is time. This is an experimental. Experiment, right? So in this case, we're saying we're assigning our sort of Hamiltonian energy to an actual experiment, and we're looking what that, you know, energy would look like, right? Yeah. Okay, let me skip this one over here. So we're saying, okay, so we think there has to be some type of active mechanism or planar polarity involved in T3. However, in T1, there have been experimental observations that say if you have more myosin on these interfaces, right, and more bazooka on these interfaces, there hasn't really been an observation that the new T3 interfaces are different, that they have like a higher recruitment of XYZ, unlike the T1 interfaces. So the question is, so where would some type of planar polarity or like an active mechanism in the T3 actually come from, right? And obviously other people have asked this question, right? So this is again from the previously cited Collinet paper and from Fernandez-Gonzalez's lab, which are saying that, okay, if there's an active active mechanism for elongating T3 interfaces, we haven't really seen anything that distinguishes the T3 interfaces from the original transverse or T1 interfaces. So maybe there has to be some mechanism that actually, right, instead of, right, being on the interfaces, right, so, you know, we don't really imagine that there's like a little homunculus sitting on the T3, which is kind of like pushing out in both directions. We actually think maybe that there's forces, right, in these medial areas, right, so radially directed forces in the medial areas of the cells that are neighboring that T3 interface, right? So, but that already means, well, we think that there's a mechanism, right, for some type of planar polarity, but this is, you know, pulling on these vertices from the inside of the cell. So how would you associate that type of process, you know, with an interface, right? So that's harder to do. There's another but wait, and that goes back to a question I had over here earlier. The question, oh no, or was it over here, right? The question of, you know, does this start at the apical end, right, or somewhere else? So all of the planar polarity that I was telling you about, right, the bazooka and the myosin and the action that goes with it, all those planar polarized populations have been reported at the apical end, right? I'm not saying there is no myosin in the more kind of like basolateral areas, but nobody has seen myosin there, right? Or, you know, people have not really reported, you know, significant populations. So all of that planar polarity is up here at the apical end. So one would expect that these types of phenomena are going to be presumably, right, propagating from the apical end to the basal end. However, that is not really what we see. So this is an example. This is, just bear with me, we really like heat maps. We do everything in heat maps that we can. So this is a change of the area of a cell, right? So this is a heat map for a single cell. This is the gradient of the area. So the red means that the cell is expanding, it's getting larger, right? The blue means that the cell is contracting its area overall. And this is the apical end, right? And this is going down to the basal end. So if all of these processes of interest were initiated at the apical end, right, you would see some phenomenon happen first at the apical end and then kind of like propagate to the basal end, right? So it should be going from like here to here. You would see these diagonal stripes. However, you actually see stuff propagating from here to here and then back to here to here. So you see diagonal stripes, but going in both directions.
So is this one cell?
One cell, yeah.
It doesn't sum to zero at any time. Does it mean lengthening or volume change? You have you can have a positive a rate of expansion all over from, oh, that's only from 0 to 12, so you have more basal.
Yeah, it goes even more basally. It goes even more basally, yeah.
In the observations where you have the full
where we have them, it looks like it's, you know, fairly conserved, but there's some uncertainty where the cells actually stop. We have some uncertainty where, like, the basal end is, right? Finding the apical end in these movies is fairly straightforward, but finding the basal end is not. So we're never sure whether we're capturing the entire length, right? But over a long length, they're conserving. They seem to be conserving volume, okay? But so important point is, you know, you might expect they're all, right, propagating from apical to basal, also going, like, sort of diagonally down this way. But you see events, you know, propagating in both directions. And the same is actually true also for the lengths. So this is a heat map for a single T1 interface, right? And again, you would expect, right, sort of everything is initiated at the basal end. You would want to see, you know, propagation of an event from here to, like, down here from the apical end, right, to the basal end. They contract first in the apical end, and that sort of contraction propagates down to the basal end. And we do see that sometimes, but we also see events where clearly, right, this is a contraction in blue, where a contraction event is first initiated, way on the basal side and actually propagates up to the apical end, right? And we've done additional ones where we go down like more like 15, right? Kind of 15 or 18, and we still see the same thing. So there are events that are propagating from basal to apical as well.
So not all T1s are the result of myosin contraction, apparently, because myosin exists only at the apical side. But there are cases where you see T1s happening, T1 processes happening at the basal and then propagating down up apical.
So how we interpret that result is kind of like another question. So as I was saying earlier, people have seen myosin populations at the apical end. That doesn't prove there is no myosin elsewhere, right? We just haven't seen, right, sort of these, you know, significant, you know, sort of liney, you know, or we haven't seen these populations that are like, you know, localized to the interfaces. So the fact that, you know, people really haven't seen myosin enrichment, right, you know, in other areas, you know, is not a sufficient proof that, you know, myosin isn't doing anything there. Right, but yes, of course, right, so the expectation was, you know, it should be propagating from the apical end. It is sometimes, but not in all cases.
So there's an interesting biology paper that shows there are fecal pools at the basal site, from which infected percolation happens from the basal to the apical.
Yeah.
So you come to that?
So we would love to be able to like see all the way down, right, so that we can track it in all cases. But like I was saying earlier, how far, where the cell is at, and basically sometimes is hard. However, we also see events where we have this kind of V shape. I'm not showing a V right here, but where you actually have a V shape going out like this, which shows that that event is, you know, actually initialized halfway along the, right, you know, sort of apical to basal axis. So we don't just have events that come apically and, you know, that come basally. I'll show you that in the next slide, actually. So this is just an example of the length, right, and this is color-coded for where it's located on the apical to basal axis. And you see here the red curve, that's the most basal that we measured in this experiment, right? You know, that this one contracts first. Length zero means it's in the T2 state, right? And now it's elongating into T3, right? And where you can see that this happens, right, you know, a good 4 minutes, right, before the apical end does. And so based on these types of plots, right, we were looking at whether, you know, when the interface reaches this T2 state, you know, length zero, whether it's reached first in the apical, right, or in the basal end. And we quantified where, right, within the length that we were looking at, it's reached first. And we see that almost 40% first reach it in the most apical slice, right? So that's kind of consistent with having, right, you know, this type of, you know, actomyosin contraction in the apical end. But we see somewhere that is first reached at, right, you know, about 2 microns, 4 microns, 6 microns. And then we have a bunch here. So, you know, if we could go further out, we would probably see a bunch more over here. But we definitely see some transitions where the shortest, right, sort of T1 state, right, or the T2 vertex is first reached at a depth of like 8 or 10 microns. So 8 or 10 microns, that's far away from like, you know, adherence junctions or tight junctions, right, you know, and tight junctions or equivalent that you have at the apical end. So from that entire, like, you know, apical region, it's far away, but it's also not at the basal end, right? So there's
immediate. You're not monitoring the basal, so it could be the one from the filopodia at the basal that just propagate to the top, and you just see the less, you know, the less space of the intercalation, right?
Yeah, but if you take this one, for example, here, right, if you take this one, you know, at 8 microns, if we're looking all the way up to 12 microns, right, it happens here before it happens here,
so
right?
Could it be one of these passive intercalations?
Potentially, right, but it's in the correct direction, right? So it could be, right, sort of, you know, whether those are fundamentally different, right, you know, whether they follow some different mechanism, but it means that, you know, for the ones that we see happening at the apical end, not all of them are initiated at the apical end.
You haven't talked about the toll receptor family, which has been shown to be. Yeah. Are you going to come to that?
No.
Okay, my question is, do you know what is their apical basal distribution?
I do not know. Yeah. Do you know if there is?
I don't know, remember how far basally they go.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
I don't think it's known, because I ask Jen this every time. I don't think it's known.
You don't think it's known?
No.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll try to be compact about this. Okay, so this is another point that says, okay, we have this idea about the model, right? You know, where this is all driven by sort of actomyosin tension at the apical end, right? So where first of all we need a mechanism for T3, right? However, that mechanism for T3 is apparently not localized to interfaces, so maybe it's, you know, to do something that happens sort of, you know, radial tensions or, you know, radial forces that are occurring. The other problem is that even at the apical end, right, and when you have these contractions occurring, they don't look to us, and I've had long discussions with Boris also about the question, you know, how can you tell quantitatively? They don't really look like springs contracting. And again, you know, a part of it is the way it looks, but this is an example where you have this is an interface coming from the side, and this interface kind of like just slides down here. Everything else stays in place, right? And this sort of, you know, you have this interface from the side, and this interface kind of like slides down. So the types of, right, sort of deformations that we would expect to see if you have like spring-like contractions of these types of interfaces is really not something we see. What we see is that we have this compensation, right? You know, one interface gets shorter. If this T1 interface gets shorter, we see that these transverse interfaces get longer, kind of like, you know, there's just a sliding of the position of the vertex along that perimeter, right? And the total stays very constant. You could say that, you know, even as a result of tension, right, you know, there could be some maintenance, but we see even, right, situations where they appear to take turns. So this is an example where this blue interface here, right, this blue interface is contracting from here to, right, this length over here. And here, first of all, we have a compensation. As the blue one gets shorter, this dark red one gets longer, right? So you see blue one contracts, dark red one gets longer. So you have like a pretty perfect compensation between them over here. And then what happens then, this other interface, right? Blue one still contracts, but you have a compensation with the other one. Over here, this was constant, but now you have blue one contracts as the other red one gets longer. So it looks to us like, you know, not like a spring, like, you know, where that entire spring contracts and pulls on both ends, but kind of like sometimes one of them contracts, right? And so, you know, for this T1 interface, it gets shorter, but sometimes this vertex here seems to slide, and sometimes this other vertex seems to slide. And the point, yeah, I'll skip maybe the cell oscillations real quick, okay? But the point that I'm trying to make is that, you know, if these vertices are moving independently, right, sometimes one vertex kind of slides, sometimes the other vertex slides, that suggests that, you know, we maybe need a model where not all of these, you know, energy terms on these properties are associated with interfaces, but maybe we need to have a model where we associate properties with vertices and not interfaces. Doesn't mean that there can't be tension, interface tension, but maybe the relative, you know, the relevant properties can come from properties that are associated with vertices and not the interfaces. So yeah, other effect is that these cells are also oscillatory. Again, we're not the first people to observe this, right? Sort of during German extension, these cells are constantly, right, sort of increasing and decreasing, right? You know, their total area. Yeah, it really kind of looks like it's pumping a little bit, right?
So is this resulting from endocytosis or folding?
We don't know.
Folding?
We don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's thought, well, you have these apical actomyosin, right? Just, you know, populations, and you know they're apparently contracting, right? But and so they're contracting, and I'm not showing this, but they're redistributing volume into the basal direction. Kind of like if you take a tube of toothpaste, right? And if you squeeze it up here, right, then it kind of like gets wider down here. So if you're squeezing up here, the cells, you know, increase their area at more basal level. So volume is conserved, right? But, you know, they undergo these cycles of contraction. And so that raises another question. If these cells are constantly changing their area, right? And what we're interested in is, you know, they're also contracting the interfaces, these T1 interfaces. How would you distinguish a contraction of a T1 interface that's due to some planar polarized process? How would you distinguish that from an interface contraction that just happens to cell area changes? If the cell area changes, the entire perimeter also changes, right? Of course, the entire perimeter goes up and down and up and down and up and down. So how would you distinguish, right, you know, the contraction of a T1 interface from these, right, oscillatory sort of contractions that are going on the entire time? And so we thought, you know, then we need to actually really study these length contraction in the context of these oscillatory changes that are taking place. The problem is they oscillate, But you know, the period, right, or the frequency of these oscillations is not perfectly constant, right? So 80 seconds, and then it's going to be 60 seconds, and it's going to be 90 seconds. So if you want to average anything useful, how would you average all these data, right? When on the time axis, sometimes you have 80 seconds, sometimes 60, sometimes 90 for one full oscillations. And the way we did this is that instead of sort of plotting everything against time, we plotted everything against phase. Right, so we said, you know, they're oscillating, right? Oscillating. So we're saying, okay, one oscillation, right, is associated with a phase of 360 degrees. We actually go from like minus 180 to plus 180, but right, same thing. So we're saying, okay, we're plotting everything against the phase. So this is an example, right, of these area oscillations over here. And so we're associating phase with it. Using a technique, it's called the oscillating circle method. This comes from the Journal of Marine Science and Technology. So we were very pleased to have this, to cite this paper. So apparently there is a lot of information, right, processing and technology that really comes from like analyzing radar signals and stuff like that. So this was interesting. But so this helped us break this down into phase, and then, you know, instead of plotting against time, we're just plotting against this phase of the oscillation. And so what we found was that these contractions of the T1 interfaces happen opportunistically always during these contraction phases. So while the cell is contracting, these interfaces are also contracting. But you know, they're not just contracting like all of the all of the interfaces do, but they're actually contracting more. So down here you have the phase. So this is pinkish beige, right? So this is the contraction phase. So this is where the cell is contracting. And this bluish area over here, this is where the cell is expanding again. And so if you had an isotropic expansion, like where nothing planar polarized ever happens, right? The cell just, you know, sort of contracting and expanding. The interface length would follow this black curve over here. So that's the black curve just follows, right, the overall change of the perimeter. So this is like the, you could say the fractional, right, sort of, you know, a portion of that one interface contracting and then elongating again. So if nothing, right, were to happen, right, you know, all of the interfaces would just, you know, go in and out and in and out. And so what we see is that the vertical interfaces, which are the contracting T1 interfaces during that phase, contract, but they contract way more, and then they stay where they are, right? They tend, you know, you can see, you know, there's a little blip over here, but their overall behavior is that during cell contraction they contract. But then during cell expansion, instead of getting longer again, they actually stay where they are. They stay the same length. Yeah? Whereas the transverse interfaces contract a little bit, but then they gain a lot more during that area.
Are you assuming that all these oscillations come from myosin contractions or because of cross-sodium membrane traffic? You're not looking at membranes.
Yeah. We think that the membrane traffic has a role in stabilizing, right? You know, these sizes, right? But overall, sort of, you know, these cell oscillations, you know, we think, you know, yeah. Well, they go away if you mess with myosin, right? So we're thinking that they're actomyosin mediated.
So there's some paper in the literature that kind of show that there's some medial pool of myosin actomyosin.
Yeah.
This medial pool kind of moves towards what would be the short shrinking junction, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it could be that this medial pool, it's also contracting the junction,
yeah.
Contracting the cell, the surface of the cell, and then eventually fusing with the shrinking junction.
Yeah.
So could this,
I'm not sure if it's required to flow. Maybe it needs to flow outward, but I'm thinking that entire, you know, medial pool of actomyosin is contracting the entire cell. Well, of course, the problem is, right, if you have the cell has one T1, the cell has another T1 on the other side, right? So, you know, it's hard to tell whether you have something that's responsible for this specific T1 or for the other T1. Yeah, but obviously I'm thinking that has something to do with it. And I would say my best theory right now is that, you know, you have these area contractions, you know, which are also going both directions, but at the same time, you also have internal pressure, right? You have volume conservation, right? So if you have contraction at the apical end, right, then sort of the fluid has to be redistributed to the basal end, right? But then so you have actually fluid pressures also, right, sort of, you know, pushing on the cell in the more basal areas. But then, right, you know, that sort of pressure pulse, right, distribution also has to come back because maybe the neighboring cell, right, is expanding. So, right, I'm thinking that, you know, at the apical end, I think the forces come from medial actomyosin, not from junctional actomyosin, but from medial actomyosin. right? And that can be pulling, right, sort of all of these vertices in the radial direction, but all of these vertices are participating in it, yeah?
Is that what this does to your minimization considerations?
Exactly, right? And we're in the process of trying to input that, but that's not straightforward, right? Because again, this would correspond in your energy term, that would mean that your target area changes over time. However, there's no well-defined time in your Monte Carlo simulation, right? So there's not really a timeline that you can associate with it. Right?
Isn't that an artifact of the fact you're taking a two-dimensional slice through a what is now revealed to be importantly dynamically three-dimensional.
Yeah, exactly, right? So, you know, this shows that, you know, there's actually different ways in which that sort of approach with the Monte Carlo simulation is going to be limited, right? Sort of both in the ways that, you know, it's, you know, these types of contractions are associated with area oscillations, which right now are not explicitly in the simulation, right? And they're probably, right, affected by three-dimensional processes, which, again, are right now not, you know, in any way explicitly associated with these types of simulations. But one more thing that I wanted to point out is, right, so that these T1s, we call that ratcheting, right? They're kind of like ratcheting down and then staying there. The fact that they stay at that short length during the during the expansion phase, that's actually also meaningful, right? Because that means, so this is the absolute length in microns. This is the fractional length of that interface, right? You know, sort of what percentage does that T1 interface have of the total cell perimeter? And that total cell perimeter, right, of course, total cell perimeter decreases during contraction and then increases again during the expansion. But so that means this vertical interface, right, sort of the fractional length decreases a lot, right? It contracts during the cell contraction phase, of course it does. But you can see the fractional length also decreases during the cell expansion phase. And the reason is that these interfaces stay the same length while the rest of the cell is expanding and the transverse interfaces are actually getting longer. So that means to this effective contraction of the T1s that we're getting, there is a contribution that actually comes from the larger than average contraction, but there is also a contribution that comes from the stabilization over here, right? And so that's something that is also, again, then therefore harder to detect, which means that if you're measuring the length of your cell, right, of course, if you see it contracting, it gets shorter, that's something you can measure. But where you can say a certain contribution to the effective, right, contraction also comes from the fact that, you know, during the time where the other interfaces of the same cell are getting longer, that interface is staying the same short lengths, right? So there's a contribution from this opportunistic contraction during cell contraction, but there's also a contribution, right, that comes from just stabilizing that length. And we think that stabilization, right, is in part associated with RAT35. I'm just going to skip that in the interest of time. But if we just decompose this motion, of the individual vertices into a radial and a tangential component, right? So if we're saying we're actually looking at how these vertices in the contracting interface displace, and we're saying any component, vectorial component that's radial doesn't interest us. Let me draw this. Vaguely hexagonal cell, right? And so as the cell contracts, these interfaces, these vertices, right, would undergo some type of, right, radial motion. But we're saying the radial motion, that's consistent with just area changes, right? And they don't really contribute anything to the effective shortening. But so what we're interested in is this, if this vertex over here is undergoing a tangential motion, right? So the tangential motion component is something that actually effectively shortens the interface, even outside of the context of these cell area oscillations.
So one thing that I guess confuses me about this is if the whole area is contracting, how do you get the individual vertices sort of sliding independently of each other?
If the whole cell is contracting, so if the entire cell is contracting, right, mm-hmm. then you want to be looking at the tangential motion, right? And that tangential motion, right, is sometimes there and sometimes not there.
Okay.
How to measure that appropriately, there's like also an issue with, you know, where your sort of reference coordinate system is, right? You know, that's not entirely trivial. but sort of in terms of like conceptually, that means the entire cell, right, and all these lengths are shortening, right, you know, doing the contraction, but this tangential component, which actually contributes to making it shorter, happens sometimes, right, you know, for one vertex and not the other. And actually, why that happens for one vertex and not the other is what I'm trying to show here, right? So that actually means, so this is again, right, the phase on the bottom, right? And so minus 80 to 0 corresponds to the contracting phase. And now we're looking at the effective motion of, let's say, this vertex over here with respect to phase. But I mean, this is a vertex between three cells. We have a cell here and a cell here and a cell here. So we wanted to know how it depends on the phase of all of these three cells. And we found that cell A, right, contracting, promotes, right, you know, this tangential sliding. Cell B contracting also promotes it, right, for reasons of symmetry, we're kind of expecting this. But for cell C, right, obviously this is not, right, promoted by cell C contracting, because cell C contracting would pull it in the other direction. So we have the most favorable conditions for, in this case, right, so phase A contracting and phase, sorry, cell A contracting and cell B contracting, that's this spot over here, right? And if cell A and B are expanding, it's much less likely. And we have anti-correlation for cell A versus cell C. So that means we have the highest likelihood of this interface, sorry, of this vertex, right, kind of like sliding down when A and B are contracting and when cell C is expanding. So our explanation why we think that, you know, we have two vertices, we have a vertex here and a vertex here, right? And both of them are sort of, you know, they're taking turns. Sometimes one is sliding, sometimes the other is sliding. Why is this one sliding, right, and not this one? I think the reason is that maybe this one has more favorable phase conditions. The phase in A and B are the same for both of these vertices, but you have a cell C up here and a cell D down here. And so maybe the relative phase conditions for A, B, and C here are very favorable because C is expanding, right? Whereas for this vertex over here, right, the phase of this cell down here might be less favorable. And so we think these vertices take turns, right? And so it's kind of like an opportunistic process. This ratcheting takes place during these cell oscillations. And we think, yeah, sometimes this slides and sometimes this slides. And which one slides depends on the sort of relative contraction area, contraction and expansion phase of all the three cells that are participating in that vertex. Yeah, you first.
How do you define your vertex displacement rate exactly? Is it in the frame of the microscope or of the three cells interface?
Oh, the displacement, yeah, that's we have like a local coordinate system, you know, where we take the cell centroids, right? You know, sort of the immediate neighborhood.
The triangular centroids, yeah. And max on the, yeah, vertical.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not entirely trivial how to find a good coordinate system for that. Yeah, but that is a local coordinate system based on the centroids. Yeah.
So these guys are mechanically coupled to each other, right? And when you think about them as phase oscillators,
yeah,
you'll have phase coupled oscillators. Right? Because, yeah, if I contract one guy, the other guy has to give.
Yeah, yeah.
So do you observe patterns?
We have looked for them, but they're not easy to find. One reason is that obviously the frequency, let me finish this up real quick. So that the period of these also changes over time, right? They're not totally constant in time. And we've obviously looked, and our working hypothesis going into this was that we thought we're going to see that, you know, these ones, let's say the row is maybe more correlated, right? And they're more anti-correlated, right? You know, to these ones up here. But right now, the data is still so noisy that we're not really seeing a huge systematic effect, right? We're kind of looking for that. We thought, oh, if they're going to be like more correlated in this dimension and sort of anti-correlated, right, you know, in this direction, that would be kind of cool. And we're also thinking, do we see that, if does this correlation, right, or anti-correlation, does it change when you form a new interface? So far, we haven't found anything yet. Obviously, that would have been really nice. Yeah.
Okay, let's take one last question.
Yeah.
So these other two red spots that you have on the top left and on the bottom right, those correspond to the single sliding, right? Only on one side.
This one over here?
One on the top left.
This one?
And on the bottom right, yes.
These are actually part of that same maximum because of the phase, right? Because this is, you know, okay, phase 360, they wrap around, right? So this is actually, you could say, you know, if you go down here, then you continue over here, and if you go left here, so these parts are basically part of that, right? You know, that same maximum over here. And the same thing over here, this one kind of like wraps around and, right, is part of that same guy down here. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.